The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. It's good to have you with us on this Friday evening. We have got a market wrap for you this evening on what's been a very profitable week. It's been a good week with the analyst and the portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Investments, David Peacock, this evening on the best week the JSE has ever had. Well, the best close the JSE has ever had on a week, over 75,000 on the JSE. Then the mother who had a problem. She looked at her child spreading everything from the grocery cupboard to the toy cupboard to everything and all over the house. She thought, I need to solve this problem. So she did. And once she'd solved that problem, she went, that's a good solution to this problem of messy children. So she sold it. No, she didn't tape the child to the wall. She took baskets and made baskets and got somebody to make the baskets. And now she is selling those baskets and is creating a micro enterprise, which is helping lots of people make a living themselves and solving problems for people with messy children, as all toddlers are. So that is a fabulous discussion for our Friday file this evening. We'll also play the Brutal Biz Quiz, the first of 2022, and bring you the best bits from the week that has been here on The Money Show before we let you go at 8 p.m.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Cost of living is rising, and that is simply a fact of life. But we are seeing some costs rise more quickly than others. Last year, we saw very, very sharp increases in fuel prices. We saw very, very sharp increase in many food prices. And this year, we're going to see an enormous single increase in the electricity price, unless you have taken advantage of the opportunity to submit written comments to the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, NERSA, ahead of what Eskom is planning to do, a 20.5% hike in electricity prices. And we know, and you know, that your local authority adds a margin on top of that for doing absolutely nothing. And therefore, electricity prices are likely to go up by as much as a quarter. That's my estimation anyway, in the not too distant future. Peter Attard-Montalto is the head of capital markets research at Intellidex. And Eskom's long-running complaint is that it's not covering the cost of production. So rather than being less corrupt and more efficient, it has simply pushed the costs onto South African consumers. And that's the same argument this time around now too, Peter.
Good evening, Bruce. Well, there are very different ways of looking at this. I mean, we are probably sitting around 35 to 40% still below cost-reflected tariffs. And the reason for that is that a lot of other reforms have not been done. The debt problem has not been sorted out. The municipal arrears problem has not been sorted out. The labour force issue at Eskom has not been sorted out. If all of those things have been sorted out, this would not be required. So Eskom really is in a very difficult position. It has to get this to cover up the policy-making inefficiencies that lie elsewhere. So I don't think we can sort of blame, or Eskom's not the ultimate ones to blame in many respects. But yes, we're going to end up with several years of very large increases. Now, you said 25%, you think, I think that could be smooth over time. I think we might see 3 years of 15% or something like that. But yes, still very substantial increases. And that kind of path has been obviously telegraphed to investors and people who care about the cost of doing business.
And again, you know, Eskom is going to push as hard as it can and do as much of the PR it can in order to scare the living daylights out of it, so that when we get a 12% increase, we go, oh, thank goodness. It's a little bit like trade union negotiations. This one hurts our back pockets directly. It is going to be inflationary, however. We are already in an interest rate tightening cycle as a result of the US starting on that particular trend in the not too distant future. We've already begun in South Africa. And there are lots of other price pressures in our economy, pushing up the cost of living for each and every South African family. Increasingly so, even as unemployment rates continue to rise.
Indeed. And I think the really interesting thing to consider is that, you know, US inflation, rather, printed at 7% this week. South Africa is actually not going to get to that kind of level. In the grand history of things, South African inflation is doing okay. Now, it might not feel like that for you and the man on the street, but I think, you know, you have to put it into context. You know, Turkish inflation is up there at sort of 40% or so. South Africa is doing okay, and we're seeing that the solid private sector is able to absorb quite a bit of this cost pressure. They were able to absorb the 15% electricity price hike last year. But the worry the Saab has, the worry we have, is that you see more years of 15% increases, and eventually you're not able to absorb that into margins as retailers, etc. And that's when you start getting these dreaded second round effects. And that's what the Saab is sort of starting to get ahead of by kicking off this very slow tightening cycle in November last year.
What gives, though, Peter? I mean, price pressures are apparent in each and every single economy in the world. Very few economies in the world have the sort of disparities that South Africa has. And if you are a middle-class, double-income household, yes, rises in household costs are uncomfortable, but they don't break you in the same way as they do in households that depend on social grants, for example, who then have to start making the choice between, warming some water or having a loaf of bread tonight, for example. It's those sorts of trade-offs that make people really, really cross.
Exactly. I think that's why this reinforces this big nexus of issues this year, including the basic income grant, all these sorts of things are all linked back to inequality, cost of living, etc., all these issues. And that's really why we have to consider this broad set of policy and political issues together this year. But basically, wages are not increasing, and with unemployment, wages are not increasing, and therefore the worker is ultimately going to take some of the brunt. The real worry for the Saab when it was have to start hiking a lot faster is if we started to see wage price pressures come through, you would then see, I think, 50-plus, 100 basis point type moves maybe by the Saab as they get more worried. We don't see that at the moment. That's why we see a pretty gradual hiking cycle to lower levels or lower peak in a cycle than in previous cycles. That's certainly the risk that we need to think about.
How concerned are you for the economic outlook for South Africa, already under pressure? We had a bounce last year, possibly close to a 5% recovery after the 7% fall in 2020. We get maybe 2% this year, maybe the same next year, without the structural reforms that I'm so bored of wondering about and that are yet to be implemented.
You're stealing my business day column on Monday, Bruce. You can read more about it there.
I'm assisting in your research. That's what I'm doing. Honing your thoughts.
There we go.
That's what we're doing.
So 2.1%. I mean, I think that's an okay-ish type level, all things considered, right? But we've talked about this so many times before. What's good on the surface, right? We have a good JSE. We have moderately good fiscal. We have a good current account. Is great, right? But we're still seeing rising inequality. We're still seeing people stuck in poverty in South Africa. And I think that's the real concern, why we need much broader and more inclusive growth. So, yes, I can certainly pick a range of numbers to be relatively bullish about this year. But, the conversation certainly after July last year, of course, now is actually what is the underlying social risk? What is the repeat of July risk, et cetera? And that's why we need to be concerned about the underlying broader pace of unemployment and inequality and things like that.
Before he gives away more, you pick up his column in Business Day on Monday. Peter Attard-Montalto on the line to us from London, the head of capital markets research at Intellidex.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
We were chatting to the makers of Savannah Cider last year, and they were very cagey about the fact that they were going to need to find a new way to deliver Savannah to you because there was a shortage of glass bottles. I eventually got them to admit, and we saw later on in the year, that Savannah started appearing more and more in aluminium cans. Frankly, I think the product suits it. South Africans generally are, South African businesses that depend on glass, whether you make jam or whether you produce drinks or whatever else you might put into glass, we are seeing some shortages. Remember Consul Glass, which is the biggest manufacturer of glass in Africa and is the subject of a takeover at the moment. It warned last year that if it had to close down its massive furnaces because of the alcohol bans, because there was less demand for beer bottles, that it would cause absolute havoc in the supply chain. And we've seen massive supply chain disruptions, not only in South Africa, but worldwide. Let's get a perspective from Terry Gale, who is the chairman of the Exporters Club of the Western Cape. It sounds like a fun club to be part of, Terry Gale. But before we get into the meat and potatoes of that, let's talk about glass shortages and the impact it's having on your members.
Thank you very much for the time and for having me on your show. Yes, obviously that has had an incredible, incredible impact and is still an ongoing impact as we know. It's not a South African thing. It's a global perspective that's been happened because of under lockdown, the severe shortage that took place. Vessels were held in ports that they could not move, vessels in particular from China moving across. When China had any cases of the coronavirus, they closed the entire port, whether it was one case, whatever the number of cases they bought. So this meant huge, huge backlogs in the global supply chain, not only coming into South Africa, which obviously affected the supply of glassware coming into our country. And as you mentioned as well, Consul had closed down due to the alcohol ban in South Africa. So they closed their factories completely and then to restart them again once we went out of the lockdown and the alcohol sales improved. So this supply from a supply point of view locally to import glassware has been a major, major challenge. Hence the reason why a lot of the product is going into other alternatives, not just glass as well. So the supply chain in particular has been heavily impacted. From a future point of view, it's very difficult to assess where we are at, what the future holds for us. I do see a glimmer of light compared to where we were a few months ago. America is the backlog is clearing in the ports of Los Angeles, Long Beach, not to the degree that we would like, but there is certain glimmer of a hope of light at the end of the tunnel.
Which is excellent news. I mean, which of your members of your exporters club have been most affected? What sort of sectors, Terry?
Well, you know, from our point from that, obviously we talk exporters. So what we have found from an exporter's perspective, what has actually happened is because of the delays, and this is because we're sitting in peak reefer season from the Western Cape, our exports, we're in the peak fruit grape exports. We're starting with the wine industry. And of course, what has happened recently, as you're aware, we had the power outage in Cape Town just before Christmas. Then we had the Christmas holidays when the port didn't work. We've also seen a lot of absenteeism in the terminals themselves due to COVID scares. So, and you know, we're looking at time-sensitive product, which obviously fruit is. It can't lie around the quayside without moving. So it is a great, great concern of ours. The concerns are being addressed, but I don't think quite as quickly as we would like them. And the holidays have actually played a huge impact because it's a double whammy from our point of view, because our chief exports are moving through when it's holiday season as well. So when you want to get hold of people, they're not people available who can assist with anything like that. So it has been quite a nightmare over the last few weeks between, as I said, probably from mid-December up until last week. And then also at the terminal itself, there were delays in the terminal. We had operational delays. We also had equipment challenges as well, which has affected our exports.
But you do suggest that things are improving. Are we improving operationally, Terry, as a ports provider? I say we loosely, it's Transnet, it's Portnet, of course. There have been efforts to restructure Portnet. I think it's early days in that process. There was a new crane that was brought from Gqeberha during December to try and alleviate some of the pressure on loading, for example, at the port of Cape Town. Are these measures having a positive impact?
Yes, I'm happy to say yes, they certainly are. As you mentioned, we did have the crane that is now working at the multipurpose terminal. So we do have that as a support system to the main terminal, which was actually out of operation for quite a few months last year. So this has an impact on us. And as I say, I think with looking at the next few weeks as well, we have a new port manager on board in Cape Town. We are meeting with him. In fact, I have as a committee and a club, we have four meetings lined up with him with next week. I think he's the right person. I don't know, but he comes with very high credentials. And he's been in Cape Town before. He did administration work for Transnet in Cape Town. So he knows the port, he knows the challenges. And I feel it's going to make a huge difference, especially engaging with us, the public, or the stakeholders, because we have to work in collaboration to resolve the problems. And I believe that's the way we're going.
Thank you very much, Terry Gale, Chairman of the Exporters Club in the Western Cape. Who knew there was a club of exporters? But there is. Terry Gale, thank you very much indeed.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Well, how secure is your crypto? I'm not asking that to David Peacock because I'm not sure that he'd be comfortable talking about crypto because he talks about other asset classes. But North Korean hackers last year stole nearly $400 million worth of digital assets in at least 7 attacks on cryptocurrency platforms last year. That's according to a report from blockchain analysis company Chain Analysis. And it said it was one of the most successful years on record for cyber criminals out of North Korea, mainly targeted at investment firms and centralized exchanges. North Korea obviously denies that it's involved in any kind of hacks and attacks, but certainly the evidence and Chain Analysis's research from 2020 to 2021, the number of North Korean-linked hacks jumped from 4 to 7, and the value extracted by those hacks grew by 40%. Phishing, code exploits, malware to siphon funds from organizations' hot wallets, moving them into North Korea. And who's going to go there to claim back their cryptocurrency? So it's a terribly clever scam. But if you do have money in cryptocurrencies and you do operate through a credible provider, a credible exchange, just give them a call from time to time and just check that their security is up to scratch. I think it's prices of cryptos under a bit of pressure, but certainly elevated relative to where they were 10, 15 years ago. It's well worth ensuring that you can protect your assets. On to markets now. David Peacock, Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. By my calculation, David Peacock, JSE closing above 75,000 is the highest close on a week in history.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. You are at this early stage in the year, correct?
I want to get ahead to give myself a running start.
So, yes, Bruce, we've had a very, very strong start to the year. I mean, we saw some really impressive prices in terms of the commodity stocks. I mean, Anglo's, for example, over 700, BHP Billiton sort of over 500. So it was a good start. I think sort of as we start moving through January, with the information that's coming out, first of all, obviously, that's been spoken about a lot already this week was specifically the inflation numbers out of the United States. And then obviously comments from the Fed and the various Fed governors talking about, you know, when are they going to see quantum easing, quantitative easing being done away with. And then, you know, with the sort of hikes that are potentially going to start coming through, you know, with their meetings in March and some, you know, some of the governors speaking of sort of maybe 4, maybe even 5 hikes going forward. So, you know, the market's taken a little bit of that into, you know, into account. And then what we saw today as markets were about to open in the U.S., Citigroup came out with a number that seemed to disappoint the market. So, you know, that stock was sort of 4% down after the release of the numbers, and U.S. stocks down sort of 0.9 at the moment. So I think we're probably going to pause for a bit of breath given those scenarios at the moment and an element of uncertainty. But, you know, whenever there's times like this, there's always the opportunity for, you know, where is the rotation in the market?
And that rotation seems to be possibly coming back to China once again. Certainly this week's iron ore consumption numbers out of China, which pushed up the Kumba iron ore share price, were very, very positive. China's got big structural problems and big problems of its own, but it does seem to be able to, when it needs to, turn up the heat a little bit in the global economy. It certainly did that after 2008, and the rest of the world was able to sort of go along the coattails of China. I wonder if 2022 is that sort of environment again or not.
Bruce, you're right in terms of, you know, Chinese turning up the heat and you know, the stimulus that the government and sort of their, in inverted commas, central bank, you know, will provide to the market to get things going in terms of, for example, industrial production, loans from banks to stimulate the economy and that sort of thing. They seem to be very resilient from that perspective. So I suppose the question really is, would that uptake in China be sufficient to make up for the possible slowdown in the United States? Because if the Citigroup numbers, which are the first to come out for quarter four, the end of 2021. If that starts sending a trend in terms of, you know, what are the numbers going to be? Valuations are quite high at the moment. The real question is, will the Chinese be able to take up that slack and provide the support to markets going forward?
Certainly markets aren't overly panicked. There's lots of panicked commentators and talking heads all around markets, and the fear of inflation, and it's the worst in 47 years, and interest rates are not rising nearly fast enough. And I can't help but wonder whether or not that fear mongering is vested interests, people looking to play markets in a different way, because I can't imagine that the US Fed is, you know, if it's in their interests to mess this up.
Yeah, there clearly is a lot at stake. And clearly, you know, the market commentators that are calling for a fall of 10 to 15%, if they are calling that sort of pullback, you know, clearly the Fed is looking at the same issues and looking at how best to address it. So I suppose the question really is, will the Fed get it wrong? Will they be too slow in terms of reacting to inflation and pushing up rates too late, or will they be a little bit early and possibly push up rates too quickly and too high? And I think a lot of that will depend on the market's reaction to the first rate hike that, you know, it will probably come through in around March, I would think, when tapering comes to, you know, to an end. So I think that is a difficulty, is that there's a fair amount of uncertainty as to exactly which way this is going to go. And Bruce, to be honest, you know, every single year there are people who are calling the market down 15 to 20%. It's overvalued, you know, et cetera. But clearly the money that's been pushed into the markets by the stimulus of various central banks clearly has been, you know, a very strong supporter, and you know, central banks can change their tack if they need to, if they want to avert what some people are, you know, would say would be a massive pullback.
Certainly policymakers, and I'm saying this with my fingers crossed and holding my breath and looking east and spitting into the wind, policymakers certainly seem to be far more effective in the last 15 years at managing the environment. Yes, it's come at a huge additional burden of debt as they've moved to save the economy time and time again than perhaps they were 20 or 30 years ago.
Exactly, Bruce. So as soon as the world, and starting with America, came off the gold standard, it became very easy for governments to be able to stimulate their economies effectively by printing money without having, you know, you don't have 1 ounce of gold equals $1. You know, so it's given a tremendous amount of leverage to governments and to the Fed and you know, around the world, where, you know, essentially if they need to stimulate, they go and stimulate and we'll sort out the problem later. The issue really in the past has been that when inflation starts getting out of control, and if you think back to sort of, I think it was in the 1970s, where inflation really got out of control and it was very difficult to pull it back, and Margaret Thatcher also played a role in that in the UK. You know, that's the thing you've got to be careful of. And hopefully within the financial system there's enough intelligence and acumen to you know, manage this process going forward.
David Peacock, he is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
See, Karen Maughan, the legal journalist, a very, very gifted and talented reporter, is on Twitter this evening in the last 12 minutes, tweeting that Judge President Dunstan Mlambo and Judge David Unterhalter both will be serving as acting justices of the Constitutional Court this term, following recommendations of the acting Chief Justice Raymond Zondo. Both Zondo, of course, and Mlambo are going to be interviewed for the position of Chief Justice next month. But great to see Dunstan Mlambo and David Unterhalter, regardless of what happens in the race for Chief Justice, really top quality legal minds in the Constitutional Court, supplementing already some very seasoned and senior minds on that particular panel. So it's nice to see that coming through this evening. I'm incredibly excited about the next Money Show. The Naked Scientist knows everything about science. But what does he know about money? He's a consultant virologist in the United Kingdom. He is a lecturer based at Cambridge University. He is astonishingly smart, and he's blown your mind on this radio station many, many times in the past. But how good is he with money? Make Money Mondays, our special guest, of course, Dr. Chris Smith on Other People's Money. That is going to be fabulous on the next Money Show. Craig Gradich from Gradich Mahura Investments is reviewing Atomic Habits by James Clear on how to change the habits and get a little bit better each and every single day. Fabulous on the next Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
I do like it when you find stories about how when somebody has a problem, they think about their problem and then they go, you know what, this is how to solve my problem. They don't go sit in a corner and navel gaze or go on to social media and cry about it and whine and whinge about it. They may cry themselves to sleep at night, but they don't tend to make it other people's problems. They work on it until they find the solution. And that's precisely what Jana Leonard did. She is the founder of Baskiti and on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. And the problem, Jana Leonard, is that toddlers are incredibly curious. And when toddlers are incredibly curious, they unpack things wherever they can reach. They could unpack shopping bags, which is not helpful because generally the stuff ends up all over the house. They could unpack washing machines that have just been packed, all sorts of things. How did you deal with the messy consequences of a toddler in the house? And then I'm not concentrating, Jana, so I'll ask you this wonderful question and give you this great big raving introduction, and then I don't put you on the line. Sorry about that. How did you cope with the how did you cope with a toddler in the house?
Hi, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me. Well, it was in the first 21 days of lockdown, and my son was 14 months old. And as you mentioned, they are extremely curious. So he found our vegetable tray and started throwing around our potatoes and sweet potatoes, and I almost lost my mind. And I thought, no, surely there must be a solution. And I came up with the concept of a hanging storage basket. And that's kind of the beginning of what Baskiti is.
Because what I did, what we did in our house was we put latches onto each and every single cupboard, which means that you can never easily open a cupboard. And also when you try and open the cupboard, invariably you get your finger trapped because you've got to depress a little lever. And then the little blighters, because they're very smart in that curiosity, also watch you overcoming the obstacle to their joy and quickly figure out how to open the cupboards themselves. So those things work. So what you did was find a good-looking solution to a problem. Yeah. And Baskiti is, as the name suggests, attractive baskets in which to store things out of the reach of little hands.
Yeah. So the concept originated thanks to my 14-month-old son, who's actually turning 3 on Sunday. So it's been quite the journey. But I wanted to create a product that I love, that looks beautiful, that everybody has open space in their homes and walls. And I wanted to open counter space up. I mean, everybody was baking banana bread in the first 21 days of lockdown. So everybody needed the kitchen space and no more vegetables and fruit baskets. So, yeah, I came up with the idea of weaving a basket that has big holes in it so your vegetables can breathe, or your potatoes, which was the original kind of concept. But, and it just grew from there. And it's amazing to see how many, when we started, how many moms actually messaged me. And they're like, you have no idea how brilliant this is, because I found potatoes in the toilet. And I'm like, oh, my word, thank goodness. I never had to experience that.
but so you create the solution for yourself. Who did you get to make the first baskets?
So our first basket was actually done by a Malawian, which we then later on, we moved the entire weaving process to Paul in Cape Town because we wanted to support our local craftsmen.
Okay. And so you started off, you made a couple of these baskets for yourself. Where did the hooks and things come from?
So the JX actually came as an addition to the banging storage basket. And we obviously, we saw the gap in the market where, well, you can't hang the basket without a hook. So we came up with the concept of the JX, and my father-in-law actually hand makes them for us.
Okay, so it's added to his skills base and given him a bit of a hustle do it. And they're very attractive wooden hooks, and they look like they're made out of composite materials in there as well. Strong. How did you get the word out that you were doing this? Because your background, as I understand it, is in public relations. You understand how to get attention.
Yes. So my background is, I've been in the PR industry for, I think, about 12 years. And I kind of live and breathe the consumer lifestyle space. So I knew I was fortunate enough to have the skills to, you know, create a story, to create a brand, and, you know, I had the contacts to get a brand live within a week. And that was kind of, that was that. So the initial 50 baskets I hustled, I messaged everybody I knew. I said, do you want a hanging storage basket? This is what it looks like. And I didn't have a product available to me at that stage, because it was handmade in Malawi, or Malawi. So I had photos, and I just hustled to sell the first 50, and we sold out within, before we launched. We launched in pre-sales, and that I knew that it was a great idea.
And social media is always a very useful tool, particularly in startup phase, to get the word out. And you've got a very active Instagram presence. Was that there from the start too?
Yeah, so we launched, like I mentioned, didn't have any professional photos or anything. So it was word of mouth, and I just asked everybody to like the page. And it grew very organically. I think it was a very lucky stage when we launched, because it was very much everybody was in their homes, spending time there, wanting to like make their space beautiful and organize their space for them, because you couldn't leave your house. So I was definitely in a position to sell that concept. And people just loved it. The media loved the idea and loved the story. And it just kind of grew organically from there.
How many of these baskets are you moving a week now? Have you plateaued? Have you tapered off? Or are you growing?
No, we are growing. We're actually on Superbalist now, and we're going to be on Yap Chef soon.
What?
So it's been a beautiful journey, which I'm very excited about. We're in Iconomy in Joburg. We're in Summer House in Willowbridge. We're in Leroux in Durbanville and Paul. So people really enjoy our product, and it sells. So yeah, we're very, very happy with that.
Have you given up your day job? I mean, seems like there's enough here to keep you incredibly busy.
No, I don't. I just don't sleep that much. I also have a 11-month-old now, so I have help, and I have a beautiful nanny Jacqueline who helps us. And we hustle. That's just the way it is.
Well, it's the nature of the beast. It really is. And I mean, you are going to get increased demand, and you are going to then, you know, with Yuppie Chef and the platforms that become available, the opportunity that brings can be a little bit of a curse in the beginning. But I think you've got what it takes, Jana.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a lovely idea. Thank you. Sorry. Yes. One more point.
Thank you. No, I just wanted to say, I think a big thing to focus on, and a trend we're seeing at the moment, is definitely local businesses thriving, and, you know, companies like The Local Edit and those type of online stores that's focusing on local craftsmanship is definitely a focus. And I think that's where we're going. And I think it's due to those type of businesses who support small businesses like us that actually makes us be successful.
May the trend continue. Jana Leonard, the founder of Baskiti. On to Yuppie Chef fairly soon. And Superbalist and Economy, or Iconomy. I think it's Economy. It's a fabulous little business in the design quarter in Four Ways. And it's remarkable, lovely story of Jana Leonard solving a problem for herself and then going, hold on a second, but other people might like this. Sharing that, as you do with friends and family. And the next thing, demand starts happening. Oh my goodness me. Problem. But she's a problem solver. Fabulous story of Jana Leonard on our Friday File this evening in a little business called Baskiti. On to the Brutal Biz Quiz in a moment. And your first question tonight is, Mteto Nyati is leaving which company? He's going at the end of June. He's been there for 5 years. What is the name of the company that Mteto Nyati has not only been running but has turned around so successfully that he thinks it's time to go? 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Do give us a shout and come and play the Brutal Biz Quiz this Friday night.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Brutal Biz Quiz time on a Friday night. Mteto Nyati is leaving which company? Temba in Centurion.
Hi, Bruce. He's leaving Altron.
Altron, absolutely right. He was brought in by the controlling Fenta family, family-controlled business, 5 years ago. And he's done a remarkable job of turning that company around. I'm looking forward to seeing what he does next. Which international company has been a bane to business leadership South Africa this week?
Nah, I'll
bail out. Oh, Temba, you're going to kick yourself. Mongadi, which company has been the bane of business leadership's existence this week? Mongadi? So shy. Theodore in Four Ways.
Sorry, repeat the question.
Which international company has been the bane of business leadership South Africa's agenda this week?
It's Bain.
Bain and Company, absolutely right. Bain and Company are members of Business Leadership South Africa after a suspension. They came back into the fold. The Zondo Commission says they've got a huge amount to answer for. Bain and Company keeps trying to push back and saying, we didn't really, it was other people, they worked for us, but it wasn't us. Don't blame us. What a mess. Business Leadership South Africa sticking to Bain for now, however. Whose rocket did the Cape Peninsula University of Technology use to send its 3 nano satellites into orbit this week?
I'm not sure of that, Bruce. Sorry.
Oh, don't apologize to me, Theodore. Apologize to yourself. Gordon in Cape Town, whose rockets did CPUT use this week to send 3 nano satellites to orbit?
Oh, gosh, and I heard this early today. So I apologize. I cannot answer it.
You're also sweet apologizing for not knowing the answers. I mean, how many people do you know who make rockets? I know one. Temba in Bertrams.
I'm sorry, Bruce. I can't answer it.
So here's a South African university using the rockets made by a South African. Des in Joburg, whose rockets is CPUT using to launch 3 nano satellites into orbit this week? No, Des doesn't want to play either. Help me, Victor in Sunning Hill. Pretty please.
I believe the SpaceX.
SpaceX is absolutely right. I was looking for Elon Musk, but he is the boss and the founder of SpaceX. So we'll take it. Absolutely right. SpaceX sending the satellites into orbit. Which East African country was plunged into darkness South Africa style on Tuesday?
Oh, my word. I didn't listen to your show that day. Kenya?
You don't need to listen because you just got an instinct for these things. I say South Africa style, but actually it was much worse. It was a nationwide blackout, the third in the past 4 years. Kenya Power said it was because a pylon fell down. Which quick service restaurant might face a boycott in China, Victor?
Whoa. Another wild guess. KFC?
Victor, you are the guest whiz of the biz quiz this evening. He's good at guessing. So I think you should go and buy lottery tickets, Victor, because if you're guessing on lottery tickets is half as good as you're guessing on the brutal biz quiz, you'll do great in the lottery too. Yeah, the China Consumers Association calling for a boycott of a KFC meal promotion, saying it encourages food waste. KFC launched the promotion last week with Pop Mart. It's a Chinese toy maker known for mystery boxes. Customers able to collect limited edition versions of large-eyed and round-faced Dimu dolls when buying certain KFC meals. It's a massively controversial issue, of course, worldwide. McDonald's got itself into all kinds of bother over doing those sorts of prizes and add-ons when it came to kids' meals in the past as well. But now KFC looks like it's facing potential pressure in China. In the next couple of minutes, Eyewitness News, followed by the best bits of The Money Show, wrapping up the week.